or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Whether you're thinking about writing a book, you are writing one, or you've already finished one and sitting on your shelf on the computer, there's one word that many authors don't want to think about. But alas, they must. The word? Marketing. With self-publishing ever easier, there's now over 2 million books in print available to compete with your book for people's ever scarcer dollars and even their eyeballs. How in the world can you get eyeballs to even read yours for free, let alone for the 99-cent bargain price, which is what the strategy that a lot of self-published ebook authors are using, let alone the 30 bucks that the typical published hardcover sells for? My guest this morning on Work with Marty Nemko is the guy whose book on that subject has the best Amazon reviews and was recommended to me personally by Richard Nelson Bowles, the author of What Calls You Parachute. His book is 1001 Ways to Market Your Books. John Kramer, welcome.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Good. So let's make this very personal to you, because it's really easy to give advice to somebody else, but I'm curious what you would actually do yourself. Let's say you wrote a brand new edition of 1001 Ways to Market your book. What would you do in that first week it's published to market it?
Well, I'd be starting 6 months in advance, working my own network with email, social networks, and things like that. So that's how I would start.
What would you do in that, when you say work your network? What not obvious thing could you share with our listeners that you would do?
Well, every time I sent out a newsletter, I would let them know that the book was coming. So I would do a lot of pre-sales even before the book was out. Then during the first week, I'd be working my network of friends and partnerships and websites that already know me and let them know that I'm doing something big. If I were in a big city, I'd be speaking a lot in the city itself at bookstores and things like that. But because I live in Taos, New Mexico, I probably wouldn't do that part of it. Mm-hmm. Unless I decided to go out to, say, San Francisco or something like that, L.A., a larger city with a lot of bookstores.
Give me a sense. You said you would work your network to tell them something big is coming. Well, you know, we live in an era of hype where everything is the biggest, newest, most important, whatever. We are hype resistant already. How would you give me an idea of actual wording? What would you put in an email that would be hypey enough to get their attention, but not so hypey they say, "Oh God, then there's that Kramer doing his marketing crap."
Well, I wouldn't really worry about that. I like to be honest. I don't like to be hypey. So I just tell them genuine, you know, what's happening. In this case, it's a new edition of the book. In fact, if I were to do 1001 Ways again, it would be the final edition because I'm getting up there in age. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people that buy every new edition, which gives me a strength that, say, some, you know, other author doesn't have if they're coming out with a book the first time around.
Sure. Let's take that more typical situation. Let's pretend that I had never written a book before, and I've killed myself for 2 or 3 years, and now my baby is done, and and I'm sending an email to all the people who know me. I'm a fool, by the way. I don't even have an email list, but that's another story. but let's say I had one. What wording would you suggest? Let's say my book, and I have two books out in 2012. Let's take the one, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. So let's say that was my first book. No previous editions. What would be the wording you would suggest I use to put in the email telling about this great, exciting event that my book, How to Do Life, is going to be available?
Well, I'm going back to 6 months ahead of time, or even a year ahead of time.
Okay.
And letting them know about it on an ongoing basis, maybe not weekly, but once a month or something like that, there would be a tweet that goes out, a Facebook post, an email newsletter, and I would start building my newsletter. Mm-hmm. If you don't have an email list, you have to start building one. And the way I would do that is by giving them something away free, a taste of the book.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So in other words, the first email might be saying, I am, you know, my tweet. Let's take it to 140 characters. Busily ensconced in writing how to do life for a quick tip on how to avoid having to go back to school, and then you have a little the URL like that.
Yes, yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And then you know, you build it up, and on the URL, wherever it is, you have a sign-up form for them to get to know more, and maybe a free excerpt already early on.
Right.
That allows them to become a fan and start to anticipate what else is coming from you.
Great. And people like to be needed, so maybe even saying, here is a draft of my section on how to land a job when you've been unemployed for 2 years. Feedback welcome. That would build their investment in the book. Is that fair?
Yeah. In any way that you could get feedback from them on the title, on the cover, mm-hmm. anything like that builds participation and a stake in the book that you have.
By the way, in terms of covers, I am thrilled with the way in which I got my covers done for the books. There's a great website called 99 Designs.
Yes.
And 99 Designs enables you for about $200. You put out a bid. You say, I am looking for a cover for this book. Here's some information about what my look and feel that I'd like. Now, all you folks out there, well, there's like thousands and thousands of designers who look to 99 Designs, submit your designs. And you get literally over 100 designs to choose from. You can give them feedback on them. And I ended up loving my covers. It's a great way to get a professional cover designed.
That is great.
Yeah. Okay. So now you said, though, that you're in Taos, New Mexico. You probably wouldn't go on to some other city. But let's say you decided to take your next edition of 1001 Ways to Market Your Book and decide you're going to go to L.A. and try to market it. Because in your book, you say that marketing your book a city at a time is a good thing. What would you do to make that airfare worth the money to go to L.A.? How would you go about maximizing that trip?
I would try to get an event in about 10 to 12 bookstores, some sort of signing. I'd do it over about a week's time, maybe 2 weeks' time. Mm-hmm. I would combine that with any kind of media appearance that I could do, local morning TV, radio, newspapers, or the local magazines. Again, some of that's going to take planning ahead, 2 to 3 months in advance.
John, how would you do it? Let's say, you know, it's really, everybody would like to be on TV to promote their book, but everybody, you know, like there are 2 million books in print right now. How would, let's pretend, John, that you found the number. Let's say I am Good Morning Los Angeles. And you dug up the name of the senior producer, and it's me. Go and tell me the pitch you would use to try to get yourself on my show.
Okay. Hey, Marty, this is John Kramer, author of a new book called 1001 Ways to Market Your Books. And I think that your audience would be really interested in what I have to offer. And here's what I'll do for you. And then I would explain something about, you know, 2 or 3 points that I think would interest anybody, in no matter who they are. Mm-hmm. And I would tell them also, hey, I can be very funny, and in the morning, that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Great. Give me an example of one. Yeah, give me an example of one tip that you would add. You say you'd give them 2 or 3 tips of the kind of thing that you think everybody would be interested in. Give me an example of one from your current edition of 1001 Ways to Market Your Books.
Okay. I would say something like, in marketing a book, one of the most important things is word of mouth. You have to create word of mouth. And the best way to start by creating word of mouth is to actually meet people in person. That's why speaking at local events is so important. And this week in L.A. alone, I will be at 6 different bookstores. Mm-hmm. And your people will want to know about that, the audience that you're trying to reach. This isn't just me coming, you know, from Taos, New Mexico. This is a local event. Things are happening here in L.A.
Great. Thank you. That was a good example. Appreciate it. So you've talked now twice about bookstores. So let's say you've called the local, all the Barnes & Nobles and the independent bookstores, anyone that looked like they were big, and voila. In fact, you know, Wonder Books has decided to let you come and do a talk. A lot of people, and I'll be honest, me too, I have given talks at about my book at bookstores, and I've sold 5 copies. So, you know, in the end, I made about $0.04 an hour for all the time that it took. I probably lost money from the gas just to get there. Any advice about how to, when you're giving a talk about your book, whether it's at a church or a Rotary Club meeting or a bookstore or a nonprofit or in a public library, any tips on how to maximize the number of books you sell there without seeming like you're a huckster?
Well, part of it is that you have to do the media. And then, you know, like the media you're doing that day, those people or listeners or viewers bookstore you're doing that night, or the event that you're doing that night, or the next night if you don't have, you know, anything going on in between. So you would always be trying to drive traffic to it. The bookstores will only do a limited amount,
sure,
unless you're a celebrity, in which case you don't have to do anything.
I didn't make my question clear. Here is, I have had very often, I'll have 100 people show up for a talk that I'll give.
Got it.
Right? And I only sell 5 books. And because I, you know, I do mention the book, and I say I'll be signing the book afterwards, and I do, you know, often, now, once or twice during the talk, we'll, you know, give a nugget from the book, and I still only sell 5 books. Now, maybe it's because I'm a terrible speaker or the book is terrible, but is there anything else that you would recommend that somebody who's giving a talk about their books do to maximize the percentage of attendees who would buy the book?
Though there are several ways you can do it. Once, you have to make the talk interactive. That means that you actually get the audience involved, have them ask questions, answer their questions, so that they really understand that you know what they need to know,
mm-hmm,
and it's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't tell them it's in the book. You give them the answer.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing you do, mm-hmm, is you give them some incentive to buy then. Hey, I'll give you an autograph. Normally, my autograph sells for $50.
Yeah, right.
You can buy the book for $22.95, or you can buy my autograph for $50.
Yeah.
You can do something fun like that.
Yeah, well.
it doesn't matter if it's not worth $50. You know, nobody's ever paid me $50 for my autograph.
No, I know. Well, that's what I mean. I really hate hype. It's, you know, it's like I break out in hives whenever I hear.
But
you know,
it's not hype. It's just fun. You can have fun with it. You interact with the audience. You just play with them, in a sense. You get them to like you as a person, they're much more likely to buy your book as well.
Absolutely. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is John Kramer. He is the author of the truly longtime best-selling and well-reviewed book on how to market your book, called 1001 Ways to Market Your Book. One of my books, the one I'm actually most excited about, it's got a cover that I love. It's got great cover quotes. It's got great Amazon reviews. It's called What's the Big Idea? 39 Reinventions for a Better America. And it sold less than 100 copies, despite my having tweeted it, Facebooked about it, blogged constantly. I didn't want to annoy people, so I didn't do it too much, but once a week for about 6 weeks, I sent it to a bunch of reviewers. I talked about it on this show. I suggested it as a topic for public affairs forums. Should I just give up and say, well, the book sucks, or it's not commercial, or what would you have me do?
Well, the first thing is you ask somebody like me that question, and then I tell everybody who's listening, hey, get out there and buy. What's the big idea? 39 Reinventions for a Better America. It's a great book.
What else should I do?
Okay, that wasn't good enough?
That was fabulous. What else should I do? I love it. I mean, you know, my real goal here is not to help me. My goal is I'm trying to give my dear listeners, and as they said, I want to tell you a story. I'm a little sidetrack here. I got into a cab one day, and I just, for the fun of it, I asked the cabbie, I say, how's the book coming? He says, how did you know I was writing a book? I said, everyone's writing a book. There was a study that showed that 80% of people say they either have a book in them, they're writing a book, or they've got one done. So this is not about me. This is about helping the many people who are listening to this show who have a book in them or already out of them market it. So what I'm trying to say is, I've told you what I did to market my book. I'm looking for a tip or two that would not only help me, but help our listeners. Give us a tip that has not been discussed yet about how you would market this particular book that I'm mentioning. What's the big idea?
Yeah, the most important thing you can do online, it's not anything to do with social network, YouTubes, anything like that. It has to do with creating a relationship with some of the larger websites that are targeting your topic or your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be looking for websites like that and then offering them some free content.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, that would be an article, but it could be an interview that they do with you,
mm-hmm,
if they have a radio show or a podcast or a mm-hmm teleseminar series that they
mm-hmm
do. Or it could just be a written interview that they put
mm-hmm
on their blog.
Good. This is good stuff. I like it a lot. Give me one more tip.
Well, then once you've created that one relationship, you go back a second time a month later or 2 months later and do the same thing again until you've built a relationship with them so that they may invite you to come and do a regular column. Now, if you're doing a regular column, let's say on, you know, one of the, say, Motley Fool,
right,
top website, high traffic, or Huffington Post or something like that,
right,
then you're going to start to get a lot of people noticing you and hopefully talking about you and your book, and that's going to make a lot of difference. The more links you get to your website, the more that you're going to sell the book.
Great suggestion. Love it. Okay. Since that was a good approach, I'm going to try a similar approach with another one of my books. The other book I've written in 2012, or at least it got published in 2012, is a book called How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. Now, I thought I was being very clever. Now I want to talk about this question, by the way, is about groups, you know, group sales, selling them by the thousands.
Right.
You know, I tried to get banks and cell phone providers to offer the book as an incentive, as a thank you for opening an account. No dice. I tried to get yearbook publishers to bind the book How to Do Life into their yearbook or sell it as a standalone add-on. No dice. I sent the ebook to the National PTA seeing if they wanted to distribute it. I sent it to college parent clubs because I thought it would be a great graduation present. Give, you know, the college parent club to give to the graduating class. Nothing. Anything else you suggest I do to try to get some entity to buy the book in large quantities?
Did you go into any of those in person and talk to somebody?
No. These were all out of my area. But, yeah, it's a good point. Yep.
You have to start, I think, in terms of building an audience for a larger corporate sale, is to try starting locally with a local corporation.
You're right. I'm not
where
social.
You can walk in and you can talk to them. You can get feedback. You can ask some dumb questions because if they've allowed you in the door, they're going to give you 20 minutes. And so then and during that time, you try to find out, well, how do I pitch you? What is it that would interest you? So you act dumb.
That's a great point. I make that mistake. I am not social by nature, so I tend to not go in person. And my insecurity makes me want to try to show how smart I am, which is exactly what turns people off. So you're right. Act dumb and walk in person. Great suggestion. Let's ask for you for one. I'm going to ask you just one now kind of overall softball question. If there's one other thing that you want to tell our listeners about how to market a book that we haven't yet discussed, what would that one other thing be?
Do something every day for every book you love.
Mm.
You have two books now that we've talked about, and you should do something every day for each one of those books. It might be send out an email, pick up the phone and call somebody, walk into an office and talk to somebody, share, tweet something, post it on Facebook, blog about it, anything like that that will give you something. Write a letter.
But do something
every day, because if you do it every day, it's going to build up over time. Most people do everything in 1 week or 2 week time, and they think, well, nobody responded, alas, nobody loves me, the book isn't a commercial success. Well, the truth is that they haven't stuck around long enough for everybody to catch up with them.
John, well, you stuck around long enough to be of great value to my listeners. I appreciate you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. His book is 1001 Ways to Market Your Books. And as I said, it is one of the most, if not the best reviewed book on Amazon. And it was personally recommended by a guy I respect a tremendous amount, Richard Nelson Bowles, the author of the 10 million copies selling What Calls Your Parachute. Again, John Kramer, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thanks a lot, Marty.
Be well. Okay, now I want to turn to you. I have the privilege of, in the next month, I'm going to be doing 5 presentations at the Commonwealth Club. The Commonwealth Club is having a month devoted to the future of work, and they've been kind enough to have me be the unprecedented, make 5 presentations during that month. So I've been working on, hard on, trying to be prepared, and I want to give you some, my dear listeners here at KALW, an advanced kind of look or hear at, of some of the things that I will be talking about. But I also want to give out the phone number. So we have plenty of time today. I deliberately wanted to do this. Leave you plenty of time for what we call 3-minute career makeovers or workovers. If you have a work-related problem, I don't care if you're unemployed, you've been unemployed for 10 years, you're self-employed, you're well-employed but want to move up, you're reasonably employed but scared about your job, you have a boss or a coworker you can't stand or a supervisee, anything related to your work life directly or indirectly. Very often people's work lives are affected by psychological crap, either psychological crap or family crap or drug crap. Whatever it is, anything that's related to work is fair game for what I do call a 3-minute career makeover or a workover. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to start by talking about trends. You know, I very often have been guilty, perhaps, of focusing on tactics, lots of little tips and tricks and stuff. I want to take a few minutes now to talk about some of the trends I'll be talking about at the Commonwealth Club. By the way, if you want to attend my presentation, just go to commonwealthclub.org. They've got all kinds of information about my about the five presentations, and they're inexpensive. So commonwealthclub.org. One of the things I certainly will be talking about is where are the job trends right now? And there's actually a little acronym that I've created that define it. I call it TTOD, T-T-O-D. The first T stands for technical, more technical. If it's something that I have seen accelerate over the last few years and seems with no sign of abatement, is it ever higher, an ever higher percentage of living wage or higher paid jobs are requiring you to be technical? Even if you're a manager, you can't just be a manager and get by on the soft skills, the communication and the listening and the organization. There really are ever more requiring you to be technical. This is going to shock you. Shocked me. You probably have heard of Indeed.com. Indeed.com aggregates about 6 million job openings of all different kinds. And they one of the things that they, one of the little services they offer is they list the top 10 terms that appear in a job title that are the fastest growing. The fastest growing terms in job titles. Would you believe these are the top 10? And remember, now, this is not just a tech website, tech jobs website. HTML5, Mongo database, iOS, that's the portable internet operating system, Android, mobile app, Puppet, which is IT automation software, Hadoop, which is analytics on large data sets, jQuery, which is a library of internet app subroutines, POS, no, it's not the Easter egg die. It's a way to rent hardware for developing and running cloud apps, and social media. All 10, highly technical. So, you know, and it's not like I'm some techie who's saying, hey, join me. I'm not particularly technical. Yes, I use Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and, you know, I do update my website, but I am no techie. And I really, frankly, don't. I'm not. I don't even like technology that much. But I would be hurting you if I didn't tell you that even if you're not technical by nature, you got to hold your nose a little bit. If you expect to be, you know, certainly there are some people who have jobs that require no technical skills at all. But everything is probabilities. Alas, in the in 2013 and beyond, the first job trend that came to mind to me is that it seems that everything is getting more technical. So that's the first T in my TTOD. Acronym for what are the job trends. I'll share some more in a few minutes. Let me give out the phone number again. If you could use some help with your career, whatever level, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, if you are a physician assistant or the head of hospital services at the Sutter Health, I can usually be of some help. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on the phone?
Yeah. You're on the phone
Thank
and on the air.
Very much. By the way, I really appreciate your modesty there with your advice that was given by Mr. Kramer. My name is Douglas.
Hi, Douglas.
And stop me because I tend to go off on tangents.
Yeah, be focused. Yeah, that's
right.
Good.
I've always been an artist, and then I specialize in high-end murals and things, mm-hmm. and color consulting and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I had two dreadful accidents, in run or something else, blah, blah, blah. So it's really, I still take a lot of time in and out of the hospital and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I have some damage to my brain from the concussions and things of life.
Oh.
But it's because of my upbringing, I tend to be stiff upper lip, da da da.
Right.
And I'm kind of have to reinvent myself, as it were.
Yeah, do you have to reinvent yourself? People who normally have developed, when you use the term high-end murals, that means you probably have quite a bit of expertise. And while you may not physically be able to do it.
Oh, I am actually now. Sorry to interrupt you. Yes.
Yeah, and can you be still creating murals?
Oh yes.
Oh, you can. Well, here's what I believe. I believe, you know, that even in these tight economic times, First of all, I've been doing some very careful research about the likelihood of President Obama getting reelected, and all the signs are that he will. I was reading the New York Times, the 538 column, and which is a very sophisticated statistical analysis, and it's almost sure he's going to win a bunch of other polls. And so why do I mention that? I mention that because one of his biggest commitments is to revitalizing the inner city. And so I believe there will be large grants ahead for beautification and revitalization. We've seen some murals already in the Mission and in other areas. But if you're a high-end muralist, I would urge you to find who are the decision makers who would give you the authorization to create high-end murals, either by yourself. You know, what I've learned is one of the most potent ways to do it is do it in partnership with a school. Have the kids help you out.
Which I really enjoy doing, by the way.
Which you do? Great. So it becomes a community effort, which is exactly the kind of hot-button words that are likely to get it funded. I would now, before he gets reelected, before he can... You know, once he gets reelected, he doesn't have to worry about reelection anymore. He can do whatever he wants. And so anything that feels at all controversial, revitalizing the inner city for some people is controversial, he won't have to pull his punches anymore. And I believe then everybody's going to jump on board. So now is the time for you to find out the 3 or 5 or 8 people in city, state, and federal government who could say yes to you. We want you to create these 18 high-end murals in the various places around the Bay Area. And I think that's going to be your smartest approach. Does that make sense?
Very, very much so.
Okay. I appreciate you calling Work with Marty Nemko. I wish you best of luck with that.
Thank you, and I'll keep you in contact. Thank you.
I'd like that. Feel free to call back. Right. Let me know how it works.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I was happy to help him, and I'm happy to help you. You've got a work problem. Probably the nicest compliment anybody ever gave me was Ron Owens on KGO, and he said I was unstumpable. I've been on his show for 25 years, and he's never had a call where I couldn't at least help the person take a baby step forward, very often a giant step. I want to help you. So, the price is certainly right. It's zero. During the week, I charge a fair amount for it, but here, this is my pro bono public service work. If you would like some free advice, the phone number here for what I call a 3-minute career makeover or workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as I was saying before, I'm going to be talking at the Commonwealth Club. Actually, Wednesday is the first kickoff address, and it's in Commonwealth Club's month on work, future of work. And one of the things I'll be talking about is job trends. And I have this acronym called TTOD, which stands for the 4 big job trends that I'm seeing. The first one I talked about how amazingly more technical we're becoming. The second one is one that makes me sad, and it's temp. America's instinct now, and especially here in the Bay Area, is really for the government to be kind to folks, whether it be Obamacare or it be Paid Family Leave Act or lots of employment rights for rights of employment lawsuits, or there's just tremendous amount of benefits that perhaps in America, in the world, maybe except maybe Sweden, we give our workers quite a bit of benefits. But unfortunately, what that also means is the employers are having ever more cost burdens. So, for example, under Obamacare, if an employer chooses to not provide health insurance, he's got to pay, if he's got 51 or more employees, he's got to pay a tax every year of $2,000 per employee. Those kinds, and the workers' comp claims, all of those things are making employers reluctant to hire. Like if you have 30 employees, you're very reluctant to go up to 51 because then you're going to suddenly have all these increased costs. So many employers are hiring temps, part-timers, to be exempt from a lot of those pressures. And so, unfortunately, the job trend I've been seeing accelerate over the last few years, especially in the Bay Area, is not hiring very few permanent full-time benefited jobs, unless you're a star. If you're a star, they have to pay you a lot and give you full-time benefited jobs. But if you're not a star, so much hiring is temp or, quote, temp to perm or internships or volunteership, and maybe it'll turn into a job. So the second job trend I'm seeing, in addition to being technical, is the great increase in the number of temporary employees. One other factor, so many employers realize, especially with it's so expensive to hire somebody in America, that paying somebody for 52 weeks a year, they don't really need you 52 weeks a year. They may need your expertise for 3 months, and that's it. And by hiring on a project basis, on a temp basis, they can do that. If they need somebody full-time, they're much more likely to go offshore where the cost of hiring aren't so great. Or it may have been that automation didn't make sense 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but now with the additional cost of hiring somebody, they're saying it makes sense maybe to buy this machine, to have the machine do it rather than a person. And, of course, technology has increased, so there are many more technological solutions. The biggest vivid example I have is appraisers. There used to be so many appraisers and adjusters hired to appraise houses, to adjust after an accident. Now, a lot of that is done by this, I think there's this mammoth program, I think it's called Goliath or Gorilla or something like that, that does most of that automatically. So, unfortunately, temp is the second job trend that I am seeing. If you need some help with your career, phone number here for a 3-minute career makeover, workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Marty. I have a question that's a little bit, I'll just tell you, I've been a project manager for many years, and then recently I've taken a couple of jobs being a executive assistant, mm-hmm. and this has worked out really well. Mm-hmm. I'm really good at it, and many of the project management skills carry over, mm-hmm. and in this economy, it's nice to have an alternative.
Right.
Problem is, okay, with the women that I work for, I find that there sometimes develops this tension where they feel like I'm getting better at doing things than they are, mm-hmm. and they find it threatening. I don't have this issue with the men mm-hmm. I work with.
Mm-hmm. We see that again. There have been many books written about that.
So what I'm asking is, should I just not work for women anymore?
That's a tough question. I wouldn't go that far, but I will talk about this. First of all, I'm just going to be touchy-feely supportive. There have been many books that have talked about the fact that women, for whatever reason, there's many exceptions. I don't want to say that all women are like this, but that many women really like to be all on the same plane, and they hate when somebody sticks their head up and is better or smarter or prettier or whatever. Then the other women play whack-a-mole, and they knock her down until she's at the same level as the rest of them. So, I mean, especially today, with the unemployment rate among men higher than women, and there's still tremendous, for whatever reasons, which we'll just leave for another day, women are actually being much more sought after than men in managerial positions. I think for you to exclude women bosses is going to get you in trouble. I think what you need to do is be more subtle. You can.
Yeah, you know, I've been downplaying a lot of my, I often just don't make any kind of suggestion, and I downplay sometimes, and I find myself thinking, well, am I being good at my job if I'm downplaying my ability?
You don't downplay your abilities. And again, it depends on these particular women, but what has worked for a number of my clients is to, where possible, give credit to them. If the germ of the idea came from them and you merely built on it, give credit, build them up. There was a study done by a woman psychologist at Berkeley named Jennifer Chapman who said you can't flatter too much. So build them up as much as you can. Give them credit. Downplay. You know, I know that feminist agency theory talks about the importance of you not, you know, women very often are apologetic and they shouldn't. And they say, I did this, I did that. But that really is nice theory. But in reality, what ironically it does, it really annoys other women. Yeah. So you want, I think, the self-effacing quality. And I'm not just speaking myself. My wife, Barbara, has used this her entire life. Yeah. Just like the previous guest said, play dumb. But my wife will play dumb a lot, will always give as much credit. Now, she doesn't lie, but she gives as much credit as she can to everybody else. She never tries to show how smart she is. She quietly builds everybody up, and she then becomes beloved. That's just, it's not... You know, it is a California cultural thing. It's not just women. It is in certain parts of the country where...
Yeah, but Barbara's in a management position, so it's easy for her to do that. I'm hired to help. And when I feel like I'm being punished for being good at my job, which is what they need me to be.
Be good at your job. Just make sure you're not self-aggrandizing. You're building other people.
Not at all.
Yeah, yeah. I can only tell you that's the best shot, and it can't be all women are not like that. There, you know, if this particular in this workplace, if those women are, there are some women who are more secure. Obviously, the kind of people, man or woman, who is going to be offended by your showing your competence or giving ideas, are losers. These are stupid people. I don't care what their gender is. They're insecure, and what you want to do is start looking now and aim high. Find,
okay.
If you like being an administrative assistant, executive assistant, great. Find an executive, male or female, who isn't so insecure, who is going to be grateful for having you coming up with ideas. But just make sure that you have to own. Sometimes, you know, I'm hearing your side of the story. What they could say is, she's just an idea a minute, and she's overwhelming. We just have to get our job done. She's a show-off. She's smart. But make sure that you are not a bragger. Make sure you're not overwhelming them with your ideas. Keep it moderate for now. And if you feel like these are just a bunch of insecure people, men or women, then start looking elsewhere. And you've got a good story and a good explanation for why you're looking elsewhere.
What are the best places to look, do you think, for a really high-level executive assistant personal assistant job?
Well,
what would you recommend?
We live in a very desirable society. So the companies that attract the highest quality people are Google and Apple. There were studies that show that Google and Apple are the number one target for Ivy grads. So those would be the two, and Amazon, which is more based in Seattle, although they have a presence here. I'd be going for those kind of prestigious companies. Mm-hmm. They're high, anything really, frankly, where the stock is high. Because if the stock is high, that means the company is growing, it's doing well. If you're a competent person, you're a competent manager or leader, you want to work for a company whose stock is on the uptick rather than Facebook, which is on the downtick.
Right. Okay, Marty. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. I'm glad you called. Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am doing 3-minute career makeovers, workovers, whatever your work problem, 415-841-4134. But before I go back to the phones, I was also talking about the fact that I'll be sharing some of, I'm giving you an advanced look at what my keynote address at the, I don't know if it's going to keynote address, my talk at the Commonwealth Club, kicking off the Commonwealth Club's month on the future of work. Some of the things I'll be talking about, and by the way, you can go to commonwealthclub.org to get more information about that. I talked about job trends, and there's an acronym that I created called TTOD, which stands for more technical, more temps, more overqualified people being hired, and more diversity. So I was fleshing out each of those for you. I've already fleshed out the technical and temp. Now I want to talk about overqualified. I am seeing, you know, you read probably recently that over 50% or about 50% of paralegal positions are now being filled by lawyers because there are so many unemployed lawyers now because everybody who is not science-oriented and wanted status and money went to law school. And the most of them really wanted to work in a very narrow area. They wanted to work in public interest law. They wanted to work for the ACLU. They wanted to work for the environment. But there are very few jobs. They work for the Justice Department. Fortunately, my daughter got a job in the Justice Department. But there aren't that many jobs in that area. And so most of the law jobs are more like one corporation fighting with another corporation. And so there's, you know, they don't want those jobs. And so they're ending up having to apply for jobs as paralegals. So lots and lots of overqualified people are being hired for jobs with lawyers being hired as paralegals is merely one example. But also, how many retail jobs, people with bachelor's degrees, are doing jobs that used to be $10 an hour jobs in retail? Or when you look now at entry-level managers at most companies, they used to hire people from San Francisco State who had a bachelor's in business in San Francisco State. Now they're hiring people with a bachelor's from Stanford or from Berkeley. There's tremendous overqualification. But the most shocking statistic is that 53.6% of bachelor's degree holders under the age of 25 last year were unemployed or underemployed. The highest share in recorded history, at least 11 years. They're more. This is a shock. This fleshes this out. Today's college graduates under the age of 25, and again, this is disproportionate, not the ones from Stanford or Harvard or Berkeley. These are the more typical. If you went to a Cal State or a UC Davis or a UC Santa Cruz, you are more likely to be employed as a waiter, wait person, bartender, or food service helper than you are as an engineer, physicist, chemist, and mathematician combined. And, you know, this is really a shock in light of the fact that we now send the highest percentage of people to college in history, over 70%, According to the U.S. government projections, only three of the 30 occupations with the largest projected number of job openings by 2020 are going to require a bachelor's degree or more. Most job openings are in professions like retail sales, fast food, truck driving. Those are jobs that aren't easily replaced by computers. And the feds are finding that college graduates, this is not a surprise, that majored in social sciences and the humanities are the least likely to find employment. So those are the first three of the four trends. I'll talk about diversity and its many interesting manifestations in a moment. But those are the first three job trends I'm seeing, and I'll be talking about those and so much more at the Commonwealth Club this Wednesday. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi. My name is Betsy, and
Hi,
we
Betsy.
Spoke, I think it was about October of last year.
Okay.
I called in. My husband is a lawyer. He's been working at a very big firm, and he had been offered a job with the government.
Right.
This ring a bell?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I was worried about going from a tremendously wonderful salary to a normal salary.
And I assure you, he should probably consider it seriously.
Best thing we ever did.
Right.
Ever.
I'm glad my advice was. I was getting nervous.
Say,
I was afraid my advice was wrong and you hated it.
No.
And, good.
No, but I have to say that we're able to do this because of my husband's financial organization.
Mm-hmm.
Our nest egg is big. The children's college funds our children are small, but there's enough money there that we don't have to worry about it for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We set ourselves up so that even though we don't have the same amount of money coming in, we're not in a panic situation about maintaining our savings.
But Betsy, I would argue
so
that
we were really lucky to be able to do that.
Betsy, I would argue that even if you hadn't saved a dime, the after-tax difference is not that great. And you know, frankly,
so
I have
Marty,
no idea.
Marty, you're wrong.
Let me finish.
Last year than he will even make this year.
Let me finish. What I'm saying is very often people are used to a lifestyle that they feel that they can't. I know what government lawyers make. They make 140, 150, 180,000.
Yeah.
Right.
Less.
Well, okay. But in six figures.
Yeah.
Right. And my point is that we, I believe, are way too materialistic a society. And I do think that generally, of course, it depends on the particular school district, that choosing the right public school and the right teachers for your kid can enable you to save money there. You don't need to live in 3,000 square feet on the peninsula. Your quality of life does not suffer that much in living in a much more modest environment. Driving an old car that's 10 or 15 year old Toyota still has another 5 or 10 years of life in it. I just think to say that you can't live on the government's quite generous over six figure salary plus incredible numbers of days off, holidays, incredible benefits, job security, and relatively small work weeks compared to, as you said, corporate law, I think I would advise my listeners, I'm not saying about you, I'm glad you've got this big nest egg, but my dear listeners, I do not want you to think that you need to have had this huge big nest egg before you could work for the government. Make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay.
I would just, it is a shock to go, it's a shock no matter what your circumstances are to go from a lot of money to less money, and we chose to do it. And it's just, I guess my point is that one of the things that enabled us to really embrace the choice was spending so much time kind of planning an exit strategy.
Yep.
So that we eventually could do it. Because we saw which way things were going. If you stay in corporate law, the hours never decrease.
That's right. They're terrible. Anyway, thank you very much for the call.
But so thank you so much for calming me down last time.
I'm delighted to do that, and I appreciate that. And, you know, if you're worried about not making enough money, even though you've got a nest egg, you know, there's nothing that provides greater calm than working. So if you don't have a great job, focus your efforts on, you know, being a stay-at-home mom. I don't know if you're a stay-at-home mom or you work, but the research shows...
I'm a stay-at-home mom for the next 2 years.
Well, for what it's worth, you know, there's good research now that show that stay-at-home moms end up not serving their children well. They become helicopter moms and denying their kids their self-efficacy and agency and the lack of social opportunities that accrue from being in lots of child care. And the stay-at-home parent ends up going crazy after a while because your brain goes to mush. I would encourage you to start now doing some thinking about you're clearly a motivated person. I encourage you to think about what you can do, which will both bring in income and be a great role model for your kids, and your kids will be more self-efficacious as a result. Quality time is in the end.
And you'll be happy to hear that once I get the kids into school and I actually have some time when the summer is over, I start writing the business plan.
Very good. And feel free to call in and run by that first draft business plan by me, and I'll give you my straight scoop.
I will. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Betsy. In terms of, you know, she talked about she did his organizational planning. And I've said this before, but it's so on topic of what she said that I want to stress this. I really think that financial planning types, you know, and now these banks are hiring all these financial, you know, salespeople, really, to get you to do your investing with them, where they're making a lot of profit. They make things more complicated than it needs to be. I swear. Now, I'm not a financial advisor. I have no licenses, so I'm not saying. I will just speak about me. Marty Nemko has made his investing life very simple and has outperformed the vast majority of people by following a very simple formula. And I'm not just saying that. Most experts would say that the following strategy enables you to outperform most people's investments. The word is a Vanguard all-in-one fund. And I am not an employee of Vanguard. I get nothing from Vanguard. They are the lowest cost. They are a shareholder-owned company. They provide really good, an array of choices that will allow you to choose the right balance for you of risk tolerance versus reward potential. Just Google Vanguard all-in-one funds. There are those funds for people who have more tolerance for risk, those who have less, for those who are what are called target retirement funds, where if you're planning to retire in 20 years, they've got one kind of fund. If you're planning to retire in 5 years, another kind of fund. Look at those, and if you simply, every time you have an extra few thousand dollars or $1,000, don't try to time the market. It's impossible. Trust me, really. Put your money in as soon as you have the equity. Make it an absolute rigid rule. Whenever you have an extra $1,000, $2,500, put it into that Vanguard fund of your choice. And that simple one sentence of advice. And yes, leave some money in a money market fund so that there's no volatility at all, so that you can have the money when you need it, or no interest checking account that has lots of ATMs. That little simple advice that I just gave you is probably going to, you know, and again, don't sue me, please, I'm not a financial advisor, will likely yield a better long-term result than most investors, and certainly when you're paying, say, one of those big bank financial advisors 1% a year, and then they put you into these mutual funds that have loads and more fees on top of it, and then you're let alone trading. I had a former assistant of mine emailed me and asked me, she says, I'm thinking about signing up for this trading, put and call options trading program. Should I do it? And I sent her some links to some really definitive articles. 98% of traders lose. It's not a game. You will lose. You know, be conservative. Vanguard is a good way to organize your life so that you have the time and the freedom from stress to pursue the career you want to pursue, rather than have to be so money-driven. No, you won't get rich quick. You may never even get rich, but it is a prudent, responsible, certainly one prudent and responsible way to invest. Now, before I go back to the phones, as I was talking about I'm going to be giving a kickoff address to the Commonwealth Club Wednesday, and I want to give you, my dear listeners here at KALW, an advance look. So, and I was talking about four job trends, and I talked about the fact that ever more jobs are technical, ever more jobs are temp, ever more overqualified people are getting hired, and the fourth one is diversity. Now, this does not just mean Black, Latino, Hispanic. There is probably no more driving vector, no more driving force that is changing the way in which everything is happening than diversity. I'm going to give you an example. Let's take, for example, right now, the American economy is slow and not projected to grow. But there are countries that are growing very fast. Do you know what the fastest growing country in the world is? Mongolia. Never even thought about it. We all hear China, India. Other fast growing ones. Macau. Brunei. Even Niger. Now, it has a very low gross national product. But there are some countries in Africa that are starting. Angola. Nigeria has always been one of the most robust in Africa. And, of course, China and India. Singapore. People who have the expertise to work with folks in those countries, either to sell them products, be a marketer of those products, open remote stores in those countries, or be a remote manager. So much management, we, you know, whether you like it or not, it is an irresistible proposition for a business that is either trying to maximize profits or scared of going out of business to do a lot of the work in Asia. And they are hiring what are called remote managers, people who are based here to manage a workforce in India or in China or Vietnam or Brunei or Macau or Israel or Ireland. That's what I mean by diversity being so central. As you all know, so much manufacturing goes on in Asia. Well, there are Americans who go and supervise. I have a client. I want to tell you something. Instead of going to the phones, I'm going to tell you the story of Michelle. Michelle was a coordinator in a large Bay Area company. I'm going to not say the company just to make sure I protect her because her name is Michelle. Of course, I won't tell you her last name. She always thought of herself as a client, always thought of herself as like a right-arm person. So she was like an admin person. And then she got divorced. And she said, you know what? That was a wake-up. She got energized, adrenalized by that. And she said, you know what? I'm tired of taking care of everybody else. I'm going to take care of myself. And so her goal was to become a manager, where she was going to be the boss. No more helping somebody else. Well, she now, I'll skip to the end of the story, and then I'll fill in how she got there. She now works for corporate social responsibility. She travels around Asia going to manufacturers to make sure that the factories are, yes, producing quality products and et cetera, but not abusing their workers. She loves her job. She's the boss. She's the inspector now. How'd she get there? First of all, how did I get her to even think that way? Normally, career counselors are always asking people, and you yourself probably, if you're thinking about changing careers, you're looking backward. You think, well, what did I do in the past, and how can I do some, you know, how can I, you know, combine those skills? No, but then, because that keeps you stuck in your past forever. I need you to, yes, look at your past to find what transferable skills might exist, but I also need you to look forward. What would you be excited to be doing? And that was what she was excited. When she was honest, she said, what I really want to do is I want to be the boss. It was as shallow as that, but that's what she wanted. So, what I had her do is I had her go to her manager, and I had her ask, I said, what do I need to do to get to be a manager? And what her boss, fortunately her boss was a nice boss, and said, you need to learn this particular software. She was working in a supply chain division. Need to learn this particular software. You need to learn survival Mandarin, because a lot of their manufacturing is in China. I suggested that you also ask permission. I know large companies get criticized a lot, but one of the wonderful things they offer, they're always offering ongoing trainings of all sorts. For example, I was at the Gap and I did a one-day big training for them. I'm going back there now. They provide great ongoing training for their employees. So I had her look at all of the courses that her corporation was offering in-house for their employees. And I said, you take this course on how to run a meeting. Because there's nothing that managers do more than run meetings. And it's an art. So I had her do that. She was a pretty aggressive, a little bit angry person. And I tried to teach her how to be assertive. You got to be assertive, yes, but without being too aggressive. And I taught her the concept I've taught to you in a past show, California couching. Very often, at least in California, there is a phraseology that you, whenever you want to make a suggestion, that is a really good phraseology, which is, you know, you made a good point, and it makes me wonder whether it might be a good idea to do X. What do you think? That formula is a way of being assertive while helping people save face. Save face is, you know, it's a cliche that it's core to the Asian culture. It's core in America, too. Save face is critical. So I taught her that. I also taught her to pretend that she was already in the role that she aspired to. She dressed like an admin. She used to wear these ruffled tops that are kind of what a cliched, you know, admin dresses like. I said, no, you dress like your boss. You dress like a manager. I use the term uniform. Dress in the uniform that managers wear. She was always like most of the other admins. She would leave 4:45. She was out the door. I said, be like a manager. It won't kill you to spend another 30 minutes. Right? I had her practice speaking up at meetings more. But I also taught her a technique, which I taught you way some back when, I don't remember when, but I told you on this show. Be the last person to speak on a topic. When there's a meeting, let everybody else blow off their thing. Let them have their say. That makes them more likely to listen to you, and they're curious, what in the world is Michelle thinking? And that way you can say, well, having listened to all of you, Mary, I appreciate what you said, and you know that point, John, that you made. And in light of what you said, I'm wondering whether it might be a good idea to do X. That's real leaderly. And as I said, now she is a corporate responsibility manager in Asia, going from factory to factory. We have time for one quick call. That's an example, by the way, of the kind of diversity that exists. The job market is huge in marketing, sales, healthcare. I love this. You know, Muslims are maybe the fastest growing population in the Bay Area. Well, Muslim women will not, even when they have to go to the doctor, they will not disrobe in front of a man. So there's a tremendous need for healthcare providers who speak Farsi or Arabic who are women. So the idea of multiculturality is huge, huge as in terms of the mega trends. Now, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. You know, I look at the clock. I shouldn't have even taken this call. Do you have a 10-second question?
Who?
You.
Oh, hi. No, I just wanted to make a comment. Recently I heard that the unemployment rate for disabled citizens is, like, really, really high right now.
It's always been very high, especially in this job market where an employer can get a fully abled person. Right. It's very tough for disabled people.
But what I want to say is that they get tax credits. People get tax credits for hiring them, and they come with their own health insurance, most likely. If you are getting Medicare or from SSI or Social Security Disability, they... say to the people, hire these people because you don't have to pay for the medicals. They get medicals for a long time after they leave us.
I love that you called. That is a great suggestion. Thanks so much for being the capstone to Work with Marty Nemco. Great. Love it. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr. And, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more 3-Minute Career Makeovers on callers. And my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate, should entrepreneurship be the fourth R? And what we like to do in our debates is we each take both sides of the debate, so you're not choosing who's the best debater. You're choosing, you get to hear all the best arguments. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.